Today is Monday, March 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Governments around the world are mobilizing resources to fight the COVID-19 outbreak.
Four large federal medical stations with 1,000 beds for New York.
Plus, using mobile technology to fight COVID-19.
And the bigger issue about how the government's going to use this data.
And efforts to move the peace process along in Afghanistan. Those stories and more are next. The hunt for ventilators and other medical supplies consumed the U.S. and Europe on Monday as new coronavirus infections soared and political wrangling stalled efforts for a quick aid package from Congress. The worldwide COVID-19 pandemic has infected an estimated 350,000 people worldwide. Most major Asian and European stock markets finished the day lower, and U.S. stock prices sank in early trading as more governments tightened restrictions to fight the pandemic. In an Associated Press interview, market analyst Jackson Wong says he expects a lot of volatility this week.
This week, the new cases and also the liquidity market will drive the whole stock markets.
Fears grow that densely crowded New York could become one of the world's biggest coronavirus hotspots. The city's mayor said hospitals are 10 days away from shortages in really basic supplies that seriously endanger both healthcare workers and patients. A surge in infections has caused a critical shortage of medical supplies in many places. Italy has already seen 18 doctors with coronavirus die, and Spain says 12% of its nearly 29,000 cases are medical workers. To combat the virus, Spain erected a field hospital in a convention center. British healthcare workers pleaded for more gear, saying that they felt like cannon fodder. On Sunday, U.S. President Donald Trump ordered the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, to ship mobile hospital centers to hard-hit states.
In addition to large quantities of supplies, I've also directed FEMA to supply the following: four large federal medical stations with 1,000 beds for New York, eight large federal medical stations with 2,000 beds for California, and three large federal medical stations and four small federal medical stations with 1,000 beds for.
Indians breathed easier on Monday as a 14-hour lockdown ordered to combat the spread of the coronavirus in India's megacities kept cars off the road and closed factories, improving air quality and letting people see blue skies instead of heavy gray smog. India has reported 415 cases of the coronavirus and 7 deaths, but health experts have warned that a big jump could be imminent, which would overwhelm the underfunded and crumbling public health infrastructure. Nearly 1 in 3 Americans are under orders to stay home to slow the spread of the coronavirus, as Ohio, Louisiana, and Delaware became the latest states to enact broad restrictions, along with the city of Philadelphia. They joined New York, California, and Illinois, as well as Connecticut and New Jersey, home to 101 million Americans combined. On Sunday, the Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, said the lockdown affecting large segments of the American public was likely to last 10 to 12 weeks or until early June. The Tokyo Olympic Committee is considering postponing the Summer Games. The AP's Julie Walker takes it from here.
This became clear after the International Olympic Committee announced Sunday it was considering a postponement because of the coronavirus. Canada says it won't send athletes unless the games are held next year, and Matt Carroll, head of Australia's Olympic Committee, says it's the right call.
We have to look after not only just our athletes and officials, but also their families who would feel in concern for their sons and their daughters.
Pressure has been mounting on the IOC not to hold the games this summer. Japan has more than 1,700 coronavirus cases, including 712 from a cruise ship with at least 43 deaths. I'm Julie Walker.
Taiwan, which has won global praise for its effective action against the coronavirus, is rolling out a mobile phone-based electronic fence that uses location tracking to ensure people who are quarantined stay that way in their homes. Michelle Quinn is VOA Silicon Valley Bureau Chief, and I spoke to her via Microsoft Teams to learn more.
So there's two things that people are trying to do with the use of technology. One is just kind of see the spread and see where resources need to go pretty quickly. And one way they're doing that is using thermometers that are connected to the internet. So they can say, hey, there's a fever's spiking in South Florida or New York City. Chances are this is unusual, atypical from the flu. So chances are this may be COVID-19. Let's get testing kits and masks to those areas. So that's one way that that's happening. Another way is trying to map kind of people's movements using smartphone technology. One thing that's really interesting is, and it's pretty new and also kind of controversial, is using people's smartphones who are in quarantine to track their movement. So there's something called, and it's pretty old, called contact tracing. And contact tracing started in the cholera era in the 1850s in London, where people would be interviewed who got sick and said, where were you today? Where were you yesterday? Who did you talk to yesterday? Now authorities around the world are trying to do this with smartphones.
Because I lived in South Korea for so long, I have a lot of friends that still live there. And they let me know that, you know, with the app that's installed on their phone, if someone in their neighborhood has contracted COVID-19, they are then alerted to where that person was and what time they were in that area so they can kind of see how likely they may have been exposed to COVID-19. But there's also a discussion to be had about privacy concerns.
Yeah, so I would be very interested in how they feel about it. So there's that whole tension between health risk and health concerns and important information we need today, each of us needs today, and the bigger issue about maybe the same level of issue about privacy and how the government's going to use this data.
I guess the other thing is that as more countries are going on lockdown, is there discussions being had about some kind of technology similar to what's already in place, whether it be South Korea or Taiwan, that could then relate data to organizations like the CDC or the WHO?
That is definitely happening. For example, I saw a headline today that Italy, Germany, and Austria are now sharing anonymized data with health authorities to help with this mapping and to help with understanding how people are moving and how the virus is spreading. So the sharing that's happening between, like, say, the apps that you described, as well as just, you know, telecom companies. What's interesting to me is that some of the civil liberties stalwarts who usually are, no, we're not going to do this, not over my dead body should this ever happen, are sort of saying different things now. For example, Senator Ron Wyden, who is a pretty important advocate for civil liberties and online freedom, put out a statement saying that he can understand and he sees the good in doing some of this as long as the only information that is needed is collected, that it's deleted when it's no longer needed, and that it isn't used by law enforcement against Americans.
That was VOA Silicon Valley Bureau Chief Michelle Quinn. And still coming up later in the program,
a Mekong activist group is asking the courts to slow down the Zhairi Dam sale of electricity to a state-owned company until an impact assessment report is made public.
You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study published by the New England Journal of Medicine suggests the coronavirus that causes COVID-19 may be able to survive in the air for 3 hours and on surfaces for periods of 4 to 3 days. The research conducted by scientists at NIH, CDC, UCLA, and Princeton University proposes the coronavirus can survive for 4 hours on copper surfaces, up to 24 hours on cardboard, and up to 2 to 3 days on plastic and stainless steel. Study authors say their findings support guidance already given by public health professionals. Avoid close contact with sick people. Avoid touching your face. If you're sick, stay home. Cover your cough or sneeze with a tissue, then throw it away. And clean and disinfect often touched objects and surfaces with a household cleaning spray or wipe. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Friday congregational prayers is a weekly service required for all adult Muslim men and allows attendees to worship and catch up with their community members. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi spoke with Shakir El-Sayed, the imam of the Darul Hijra Islamic Center, about steps they've taken to counter the spread of the coronavirus.
First of all, we announced that we are canceling all congregational prayers, including Friday prayers, which is quite unfortunate, so that we don't allow for our great big gatherings to be a cause for transmission of the disease. We also sent several advisories to our community based on the CDC instructions as to hygienic measures and the personal conduct and social activities and so many other things. We also, of course, started to do some educational programs online, and we're getting, mashallah, great response from the community to join those activities to kind of like substitute. We sent several guidelines for educational activities for the kids online that are compliant with their, you know, age groups and Islamic requirements. So basically, these are the measures. We also have some doctors update us on the situation from CDC, from NIH. So we're working with the development of the situation almost by the hour. So we're monitoring what's going on, and we are adapting as things develop.
Friday prayers is a weekly service required for adult Muslim men and a time dedicated for all attendees to worship and catch up with their fellow community members. How did your community receive your decision of halting Friday prayers?
Definitely, some of them were distraught, and some of them, the majority, in fact, were very positively responding, recognizing that the information we have used are legitimate. We made the decision after the county had canceled the school for children in the whole county and several other counties. We also did it after the governor had announced the state of emergency in Virginia. So we did not act on our own feelings or judgment. We have a government liaison who reaches out to government agencies to keep us informed on the development of the medical establishment assessment of the situation.
With Ramadan only 5 weeks away, traditionally Muslim Americans participate in communal fast-breaking meals and night prayers as pillars of Ramadan traditions. Did you think of an alternative for worshippers to keep up with the rituals while keeping the social distance?
Having a meeting to discuss the Ramadan adjustments for plans, and if the situation improves, which is not very likely in the near future, we're going to look into develop alternative plans for both cases.
Could people pray remotely?
They could pray in smaller groups in. They could gather as a family in small numbers because the larger the number you get, the bigger the chance for transmitting infection. And because this disease in particular, this virus, stay kind of like in hiding without showing symptoms for days on end, no one could tell if somebody was actually carrying the virus. Some people carry the virus to others when the immune system is good, so they never show symptoms of being sick because the immune system is good. But those whose immune system is compromised for one reason or another, they get infected and they show symptoms immediately. So being healthy is not a license to mix with others because you may assume you're healthy because your immune system is good, but you actually may be carrying the virus.
Shakir El-Sayed is the imam of the Darul Hijra Islamic Center. He spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi. In Asia, Autumn Kim is the director of the International Healthcare Center in South Korea. That nation has been hit hard by the coronavirus. She recently spoke with VOA to share her story of living through the outbreak.
My name is Arim Kim, and I'm a doctor of internal medicine specializing in infectious disease. Also, I'm a director of International Healthcare Center in Inha University Hospital in South Korea. I have two daughters, and first one is 10 years old, and the other one is 6 years old, and now they're at home. They're watching TV. It's normal for a mother to worry about their kids, especially when she works for a hospital, like medical personnel. But for my kids, when MERS happened before, then since then, I have been trained well, especially like about putting on and take them off, I mean, personal protective equipment. So when I see patients suspicious of COVID-19, I'm really cautious. So I'm not worried too much about my kids. I felt like our people in Korea was really prepared, because when we heard there was confirmed case of COVID-19, probably late January, then my hospital, just next day, we had meeting, kind of emergency meeting with infectious control committee. I feel like we have been doing really well to protect our patients, especially hospitalized, immunocompromised patients in my hospital. I was thinking yesterday, overall, it has been rewarding experience for me, and I'm proud of being a doctor in Korea. Maybe some other doctors wouldn't agree on that, but it's like when I see patients, I feel like he has symptoms and need to be tested, and then I can do tests on him right away, and then next day I will get the outcome. And if patient have concern because he has respiratory symptoms or close contact or travel, then also he can be tested, and he doesn't have any concern about how am I going to afford this, you know, cost-wise, medical cost, because government is going to support all the cost if they have suspicious symptoms. And because I heard from my friend, the Korean living in Atlanta, he's also family medicine doctor, and he was telling me that how frustrated it has been for him that he really cannot do the test like I do, even though he wants to. My great concerns, you know, the patients at high risk, if they can be diagnosed earlier, then there is more chance maybe they can survive. So as a physician, that must be really heartbreaking for me if I were their physician. So that's my main concern.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo arrived in Kabul, Afghanistan on Monday. It was a previously unannounced visit to try and resolve a political dispute between President Ashraf Ghani and his rival, Abdullah Abdullah, that has threatened to derail a deal between the U.S. and the Taliban that was signed last month. After weeks of squabbling, the Afghan government and the Taliban made their first direct official contact on Sunday using Skype video conferencing facilities to discuss the issue of prisoner release. The issue of the release of up to 5,000 Taliban prisoners in return for up to 1,000 Afghan security personnel has been holding up the start of negotiations between the Taliban and other Afghan factions that were supposed to commence on the 10th of March, as per the deal that was signed between the U.S. and the Taliban in Doha last month. The Taliban leadership has long refused to negotiate with the Afghan government, calling it a puppet of the Americans. Instead, they have agreed to negotiate with a team of Afghans, including representatives of various political factions, including the government, civil society activists, women, and others. The Mekong River travels through several Asian countries. A series of dams on the river has reduced water levels, damaging fisheries and causing other environmental problems for the people who depend on the waterway for their livelihoods and food. Now, the latest dam, the Lao-owned Xiburi, begins operations on the lower Mekong. A Thai activist group is going to court to slow down the sale of electricity to Thai companies. Steve Stanford speaks to those who've been affected.
Life on the Mekong has changed dramatically in the last 6 months, with increased water shortages following the Xiburi dam's startup. Studies warning about the dam's impact on the river's ecosystem have come true, as fishermen are seeing aquatic habitat disappear and water levels dip. But that's not all.
The water has changed and the color has changed. When the water was natural, it was not clear like this, and it would have sediments and nutrients in there. The water is clear, but the sediments and nutrients have gone.
Now, a Mekong activist group is asking the courts to slow down the Xiburi Dam's sale of electricity to a state-owned company, until an impact assessment report is made public.
We can't get access to the information and get access to the public hearing event that's organized by the Natural Resources Department that was part of the Mekong River Commission. They can't give us 100% information regarding our concerns.
For farmers like Sinit Kuhn, who rely heavily on the water for irrigation, the options are drying up.
Because the water is so shallow, it's difficult for the pump to suck the water out, to distribute the water evenly to the rice and corn fields. It has gone down from 100 to 40%.
The Zyberry Power Company says it has spent hundreds of millions of dollars to mitigate the negative environmental impacts, including building outlets for sediment passage and flow, and for allowing the passage of fish. Village leader Apinan Utima says the problem can only be resolved by cooperation between affected countries.
We have to find a way how we can live together, because right now the villagers have no choice, don't know what to do anymore, so we only can ask help from the government to be our voice to talk and negotiate between countries.
With the Thai government set to meet with the villagers next month, time will tell what will remain of the river once the dust settles on the future of the Zyberry Dam. Steve Sanford for VOA News in Nong Khai, Thailand.
Rising seas are causing inland flooding around the world. This is especially true in Miami, Florida, where high tides are flooding buildings and roads, threatening drinking water and causing soil erosion. As we hear from VOA's Deborah Block, scientists say one of the most effective ways to hold back the tides is through Mother Nature.
In low-lying coastal communities like Miami and nearby Miami Beach, rising tides linked to climate change are causing chronic flooding. While scientific studies differ on how much further the tides will rise, elevated sea levels eventually could put vast stretches of Florida underwater.
We're trying to project how fast we're expecting them to rise so we can plan how we're going to protect our communities for the future.
To help control the damage from flooding, some roads and buildings have been elevated and seawalls are being reinforced.
Water may be coming up over seawalls and it's causing flooding on their backyards or in their properties. On the roads, it means that water could be coming up our drainage systems and actually causing flooding on sunny days.
Beyond man-made solutions, natural resources like mangrove forests can help with flood protection. Mangroves are small trees that grow in salty water. Mangrove forests help prevent erosion and provide a natural buffer against storm surges. Here at Miami Beach's Oleta State Park, this mangrove forest winds around a creek.
Even though this area is surrounded by a lot of high development, it will reduce flooding.
Mangroves also combat the biggest driver of climate change.
Mangroves are the one group of tree species that sequester more carbon than any other trees on Earth because they have quite a large underground root structure. So by storing carbon, it takes it out of the atmosphere, which can help reduce our greenhouse gases.
Florida's mangrove forests are under threat, something conservationists hope to reverse.
Most of our mangroves have been eliminated for development, but as sea level rises, some areas will no longer be inhabitable, and they'll maybe some homes and other structures will be removed.
We used to be a mangrove island, and we recognize that bringing back those mangroves is going to help us be better protected for the future.
Her advice to other places worldwide with rising seas?
In areas that you have that are undeveloped, definitely look first and see how you can preserve nature as much as possible rather than then trying to bring it in once you've developed those areas.
Deborah Block, VOA News, Miami Beach.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team in Washington, thank you very much for listening and spending part of your day with us. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have an absolutely fantastic day.